From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA African Division journalist Salem Solomon. Our topic on this edition of the program, how do global population changes and migratory trends affect national and international politics? We examine political demography with one of the foremost experts in the field, Professor Jack Goldstone, professor of public policy at George Mason University in the state of Virginia and a global fellow of the Woodrow Wilson International Center here in Washington. He's co-editor of the 2011 book, Political Demography, How Population Changes Are Reshaping International Security and National Politics. Professor Goldstone has written more than 100 articles and authored or edited at least 13 books on political demography, social movements and revolutions, democratization, and long-term social change. His 2010 essay in Foreign Affairs magazine, The Population Bomb, received worldwide attention. His current research focuses on conditions for building democracy and stability in developing nations, the impact of population change on the global economy and international security, and the cultural origins of modern economic growth. And Jack Goldstone joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, journalist Salem Solomon.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Professor Goldstone, let me start with asking you what the relationship between current demographic trends around the world and politics are. How do you see the current trends in both the developed and developing world?
Well, there are several key trends. Let's focus on three. One is that the rich countries are getting older. They've been very successful in extending life expectancy, and people are also choosing to have fewer children. The result is, as the baby boomers get older, the number of young workers coming up behind them is much smaller. So that aging is one major trend, and that's going to affect state finance, taxation. It's already had a big effect on economic growth and inflation. You may have noticed that we haven't seen any real inflation in the rich countries for many years, and that's partly because of low rates of population growth, low rates of new household formation. Trend number two is the still rapid population growth in an arc of countries going, say, from Central America across to Africa and to the Middle East and parts of South Asia. There are about a billion, billion and a half people living in countries that still have rapid population growth. And for those countries, we're looking at young populations, fast-growing populations for the next 20 or 30 years. So kind of mirror images here with rich countries getting older and a number of developing countries getting younger. And the third trend, which is kind of a result of the first two, is international migration. We've seen quite an uptick in the migration of people from all over Asia and Africa and South America to both the United States and to European countries. Now, there are two aspects to this migration. The kind of steady, well-regulated movement of people looking for work has been a boon for those countries facing a shrinking labor force, Europe and the U.S. What's been difficult are the kind of unexpected surges of migrants that come from climate and civil war type disasters. So the surge of immigrants from Syria to Europe, the surge of immigrants that just lasted a couple of years, 2015, 2016, had huge disruptive impact on European politics. It spurred anti-immigrant parties. It shifted politics to the right across the continent. It left the existing mainstream parties looking unprepared and unskilled in protecting their own populations. Similarly, the surge of immigrants from Central America, following high levels of violence and terrible drought that destroyed crops across Guatemala and Honduras, created a problem at America's southern border. And that also, as we know, has had big political impacts on how people view U.S. immigration policy and how they view what they expect the president to do. So I'd say three trends: aging in parts of the world, more and more young people in other parts of the world, and migration that is sometimes unexpectedly rapid and sudden that really does cause anxiety.
That's a terrific explanation of what we're experiencing. And to follow up, let me turn to my colleague, Salem Solomon, for a question.
Thank you so much for that detailed tracking of the trends. The world is obviously becoming interconnected, as we see, and diversity is becoming, you know, enriched societies. But, you know, it has also provoked a lot of backlash, as you mentioned. As you see migration affecting politics, is this kind of backlash a short-term trend from what you study in response to globalization, or is it a sign of worse things to come?
It may be a bit of both. I'm sorry to give you a muddy answer like that, but we're talking about millions of people with a variety of attitudes, and they respond to different things. There are certainly many people in Europe and the United States who have a kind of nostalgia for the type of country they remember growing up in 30, 40 years ago. 30, 40 years ago, the majority of immigrants in the United States were of European descent. And in Europe, there was very little immigration at all. Mass migration to Europe really only began in the 80s and 90s. So for people who simply want to go back to a time when their neighbors looked and sounded just like them, you have a situation where, sure, there's a lot of resentment and fear about losing the character of their country. And to the extent that politicians fan that fear and play on it and make it come out as anger, we see a terrible increase in hate crimes against foreigners. But that's a minority. I think there are other people who have a more reasonable concern. Say you live in a house. You have guests over occasionally. But if you were to say, I'm only going to have people who I've known in the neighborhood for 30 years and family, and I'm not going to let anyone else in my house, you'd lead a lonelier life. You'd have fewer connections. Your own future would be weaker. On the other hand, you wouldn't want to live in a house where the door is open all the time if new people are moving into the neighborhood. You'd want to have some control over who you meet and who comes in. And the immigration policy fight sometimes seems to be caught between those extremes. Either people think the door is wide open for anyone to come in, which is not true, or they're afraid that immigration will be shut down and we'll lose all the energy and novelty and variety that has come from long-term immigration that's helped make America the country it is. The reality is we're struggling to find policies that will reassure people. Yes, immigrants are being vetted. They're being examined for a criminal record. But if they have a sound background, they're welcome to come and to find work and make their contribution. We just are confused now because the immigration laws we have in America and Europe have kind of grown up piecemeal. They don't cope well with surges of asylum seekers. They don't cope well with immigrants coming from new sources. And that's what we're seeing now, more immigrants coming from Asia and fewer from Mexico. So we have to change and adapt. And until we do, people will be anxious because they don't feel comfortable that the laws are protecting them.
One thing I would like to add on the factors that are driving people to move out. I cover the continent of Africa extensively. There are different factors that push people out. Africa happens to be the youngest continent. There's what it's called the youth bulge, for instance. And you study very closely about what kind of conditions would lead to successful democracies. And in that way, of course, you provide education and economic opportunities to young people. So my question may be tying both together, looking across the continent, what effects do you see or do you think the youth bulge that the continent is having would have on democratic institutions and not bleeding people out of the continent, for instance?
One has to look at the youth bulge in Africa in terms of how does it affect the countries in Africa and what are the implications for the rest of the world? In terms of what's happening in Africa, population growth is continuing at high levels. Now, that's not necessarily awful in some ways because Africa is a big continent. It has capacity to improve its food output. The difficulty in Africa is that the governments tend to be weak in resources and they have a hard time providing education and stable jobs in the formal sector for these large youth cohorts. That leads to frustration and can lead to political unrest. Now, one opportunity is to help some of the most ambitious and energetic young people go abroad and look for work. And that's turned out to be a good thing for, it's a win-win situation for both sides, because if young people go abroad, they acquire skills and experience that they can bring back home. So, for example, the U.S., people used to worry about migration from Mexico, but we've now reached the point where more Mexicans go back across the border south to Mexico than come from Mexico to the U.S., because a generation of earlier migrants who came here worked, saved money, gained skills, they're going back to either retire or to start companies of their own in Mexico. Same thing has happened with immigrants from Asia. A lot of the Chinese companies that are now our competitors, they started using experience from people who went overseas and then came back. Same thing in India. So that kind of circular migration is both a safety valve for fast-growing countries in Africa, but also a support to their long-term growth. Now, from the point of view of the rich countries, there's a tendency to demonize young people from abroad. Oh, they're gang members. Oh, they're criminals. Well, the data doesn't support that. If you look at the data on immigrants in the United States and you look at state crimes, robbery, murder, a lot more of that is, unfortunately, produced by native-born than by immigrants. Immigrants have every incentive to stay clean, to work hard. Otherwise, they know that everything they hoped for, everything they moved for, is going to be lost. So it's true and not surprising that crime rates are lower for immigrants. But even more important, given that the birth rates have fallen so low in Europe and America, even in America, it's now down for everybody, not just whites, but for everybody, it's down to 1.75 is the average children per woman. So below replacement. And that means having smart, young, energetic workers, that's a scarce resource. Now, if we were running out of oil or running out of uranium, we'd be going around the world to say, where can we find it? How do we refine it? How do we bring it to our country? But what we're actually in danger of running out of are young workers, right? Look at the unemployment rate in this country. It's at historic lows. There are tens of thousands of jobs going unfilled. The major restraint on companies expanding is lack of workers. So we need to view young people abroad as another scarce resource. And we should be doing everything we can. We cultivate them, educate them. In fact, because China, Japan, South Korea, Europe, and the U.S. are all running low on young people and workers, we're actually going to be competing with other countries to try and attract the workers we need. Can't take it for granted.
Well, that leads me to ask you a follow-up on that, Jack, but we'll do so after the break. First, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Professor Jack Goldstone. He's co-editor of Political Demography, How Population Changes Are Reshaping International Security and National Politics. He's also professor of public policy at George Mason University. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA African Division journalist Salem Solomon. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Enodu Emmanuel Onyedi from Gombe State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to you, Jack Goldstone. If indeed here in the United States and even in Europe, if the population trends are going down, people are having fewer children, and we actually need more workers, youth, why then do we see this virulent anti-immigrant sentiment? Are we seeing a resurgence of bigotry, xenophobia, notwithstanding the fact that our economies actually need more people from the outside? How do you reconcile this?
Actually, if you look at opinion polls in the United States, in the last few years, larger majorities have said they believe immigration makes America stronger. There's not hostility to immigration in principle, but there is hostility to immigration that seems to be sudden or uncontrolled or undeserved. So we need to have regular, well-ordered immigration to reassure people that the people who are entering this country or entering Great Britain or entering France are people who are coming here to work, have places to go, and will be an asset to the country. It's not that hard. We actually have programs for settling overseas refugees that do all of these things. Applicants are vetted. They have to identify family or hosts that will sponsor them. They have to wait for their immigration to be handled. And they're only allowed to enter the country after they've satisfied conditions that indicate they'll be an asset.
That may be true, but we seem to be short on facts. We see the politicization of these topics. For example, even President Trump, anti-immigration is one of his signature policies. He's against immigrants. We are reducing the number of refugees we used to take in this country. And it seems to be contrary to our needs. And he's distorting in many ways, and others who sympathize with this sentiment are really distorting the facts. Not all Mexicans are rapists or murderers, etc. There may be some bad apples, certainly. But like you said, we have policies that vet our immigrants and refugees. People need to communicate those facts to the American people.
There's a lot of crazy talk about immigration, frankly. But there's also common sense breaking through. In this country, there are many areas in which I would have to say the crazy talk is drowning out the common sense. It's not just immigration. It's a lot of different areas, because the tone of politics in the last few years, I think, has gotten more extreme. And some of the reasons for that is that we went through a horrible, wrenching recession in 2008, 2009. A lot of people lost homes and assets. They're angry. We're still struggling with a very high degree of economic inequality. I just saw the statistics for this week. They said in the last 2 years since the Trump tax cut, almost all the benefit has gone to income growth in the major metropolitan areas. And small town and rural areas have seen almost no income gains. So there's a lot of frustration and there's a lot of anger. And it's easy to tap that anger by pointing to bad people. But again, as I say, there's crazy talk. For example, the president says the way the lottery system works, other countries choose who to send us, and they don't choose their best people. But that's nonsense. The reason the lottery was set up is that the majority of our immigration policies favor people who are uniting with family already in the United States. Now, that's entirely reasonable. But there's a huge pool of potential talent, engineers, doctors, nurses, entrepreneurs, who are coming from countries where they don't happen to have family. And it would be harmful to the U.S. to shut those people out altogether. So we allow those people to apply. We put their names in a lottery, and then we select a number of them who we are able to vet and examine and give an opportunity to be considered for immigration. We do that for our own benefit. To say that other countries are choosing bad people, unfortunately, that's crazy talk.
Well, that's true. Just quickly, so we're getting a lot of disinformation from our own politicians, and it's incumbent on Americans, Europeans, Africans, people around the world to use their critical skills and thinking to be able to distinguish truth from fiction and do research before they just believe anything a politician says. I want to ask you quickly about the impact of uprisings, democratic uprisings, but also mostly conflicts, and how they are fueling immigration trends, for example, whether from Iraq, Afghanistan, and most recently Syria, the terrible Syrian civil war that America and other countries, particularly in Europe, didn't do enough, in my view, to help stop. So we're seeing immigrants, it's not that they want to leave, but they have to leave. They're facing violence and bloodshed. Again, the question is, do the United States, the European Union, do they realize that they are partly responsible for spawning the very migratory trends from these countries that they so vilify and so denigrate?
Unfortunately, the number of displaced people in the world today has reached all-time highs. 60 million people are currently listed as displaced, mostly by war, but some by environmental disasters as well. Those severe droughts and terrible floods and crop failures, unfortunately, are getting worse because climate change is continuing to accelerate. But it's civil war that really makes people run for their lives and has been the big driver. I used to say that the upside of wars and revolutions around the world is that Washington, D.C. gets new ethnic cuisine. So we got El Salvadorian restaurants, we got Afghan restaurants, we got Ethiopian restaurants, Vietnamese restaurants. But the tragedy behind those is millions of people losing their homes and losing their lives.
Right. They're losing their homes, they're losing their lives, they're enriching our country with their incredible skills. Many of them are doctors, engineers who have had to flee. And then the other side, of course, we have a country like Syria and others who are falling apart. This is another consequence of uprisings and civil war, that whole countries now are disintegrating before our eyes.
If we are really frightened of waves of mass migration, The only way to limit that risk is to help support better governance in developing countries.
I do feel like in this discussion, what's missing out is understanding the terms we use about how we identify who is a migrant, who is a refugee, and who is an asylum seeker, right? Whether you have someone who's a doctor, who's a trained doctor, who can contribute to the society. These terms really are very conflated in the understanding of how we identify people. When someone doesn't have a choice, how do you make a distinction when you're talking about immigrants who choose to move and refugees and asylum seekers who don't have that choice?
Ideally, we would have better international legal regimes. The United Nations has just promoted a new global pact for refugees. Throughout history, whether it's the Irish fleeing famine or Germans who also fled potato famine, the U.S. has taken in people who were suffering and looking for new opportunities. And there's a myth that, oh, the country is now full, we're crowded. Well, I drove from Washington to California this summer. There's empty space as far as the eye can see. America is still a land of opportunity. We don't need to worry about having too many people. We're a low-density country compared to any country in Europe or Asia. The fear, again, is that uncontrolled, is it an open door? Can anyone come through? The way that we have to deal with these tragedies, and there will be civil wars, there will be massive droughts, there will be suffering, it really is a two-stage process. There are mechanisms that are not adequately funded right now, but there are mechanisms for the United Nations Commissioner for Refugees and for other organizations to set up temporary relief opportunities, temporary housing, temporary camps for people who are fleeing a battle zone or fleeing a zone where they can no longer provide for themselves. Those refugee camps can be clean, safe, and well-run, but they're not a permanent solution. People need an opportunity to work, to have a society. So from those refugee camps, stage two is a process of vetting, identifying host families and communities, and providing work permits to facilitate the orderly movement of refugees and asylum seekers into secure and productive roles in their new society. But if you don't have the first stage, if you don't have the emergency relief, then you get people simply running with whatever they can grab, trying to sneak across borders, and that creates the problems of anxiety and fear that are hurtful to everyone.
Professor Goldstone, let's talk about the impact of globalization on migratory trends and also the rise of populist leaders and nationalistic trends, because we were told, and for the most part, globalization has been a positive thing. The integration of global economies, the use of comparative advantage. One country specializes in a particular commodity or industry that offsets another country's specialization. We trade among each other. But we are seeing a backlash. We're seeing workers being displaced and not retrained for other industries. Talk about how you think we should be dealing with this, because it looks like the backlash to it, and that is the rise of populism, the anti-trade sentiment we're seeing here in the United States. I don't know that that is the answer.
Globalization has been, by and large, a boon for people. They take for granted the ability to buy cheap goods from overseas, to get access to the global world of culture and entertainment. But the backlash is understandable, too, for two reasons. First of all, there are just some real surprises. Most people don't know that there are somewhere between 500,000 and 2 million Africans living in China. They migrated there to start trading businesses to bring cheap Chinese goods to Africa and fill a niche. The Chinese, however, are like, wait a minute, we don't quite understand why anyone would migrate to China if you're not Chinese. They don't realize that as China's gone from a poor country to an increasingly wealthy and globally important one, other people from around the world will want to come to China and share in its growth and success. But they're completely unprepared to deal with migration. So a lot of people just don't anticipate the effects of globalization and therefore are kind of surprised. And I have to blame people like myself, East Coast intellectuals who were pretty stupid about some aspects of globalization. And when I say stupid, I mean we kind of said, oh, well, globalization will provide economic growth and good. We didn't pay close enough attention to how that growth and its benefits would be distributed. A lot of American workers did lose out from the changing of global supply chains. A lot lost out from the shifts in technology that accompanied globalization. We didn't do enough to make sure that the benefits would be broadly distributed. And that's our fault.
Exactly. And unfortunately, though, going the other direction, the other extreme, which is to reject globalization, I've heard some analysts say that President Trump appears to want to really dismantle the global trading system by virtue of the tariffs he's imposing on China, the positions he takes vis-a-vis trade and multilateral trade deals. But for generations, we have not done enough here in this country to train people, let's say, who are in the coal industry or oil, to be prepared for non-fossil energy sources and retrain them for other. So I wonder, you know, to what extent you think we're going to start to do that?
Well, President Trump ran as a businessman, and in a sense, he's representative of a type of thinking that prevailed in global business for the last 20, 30 years. And the focus was increase profits at the expense of everything else. Now, that was a mantra for American business. If you run a country like that, you say, well, we have to increase our profits in trading with every other partner. And if we're at the moment running a trade deficit, we have to fix that. And that has become a single-minded focus for the administration's trade and international policy. But even American businessmen have realized this approach did not have the outcomes they hoped for. Instead of creating a stronger, more respected business community and a stronger community of consumers and suppliers, this single-minded focus on profits led to weakening the supply chain and spreading it outside the country. It led to squeezing workers and led to, frankly, hatred and backlash against corporate America and elites. We're seeing the same kind of hatred and backlash against globalization if globalization means one and only one thing, and that is increasing profits at the expense of American workers and American citizens. Now, Trump feels that he can change that by attacking trade imbalances. Most economists will say, that's really not going to do that. That's kind of a short-sighted real estate property basis for adding up wins and losses. The American Business Roundtable came out a couple of weeks ago and said, what we really need to do is go back to thinking of business as one element in a diverse, multi-stakeholder society. We need to run our businesses to make sure that our customers, our workers, and our suppliers are all better off if the company's better off. And in a way, globalization needs to be run the same way. America has to make sure that not only are American citizens better off, which is imperative, but we want our neighbors to be better off and our allies to be better off, because only if we're all better off are we going to be strong enough to deal with these threats of environment, civil violence, and war that are going to be on our doorstep.
Just a quick comment. The fact that the United States pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, both of these perhaps were antithetical to the very goals that President Trump would like to achieve, and that is better trading relationships, fair trade, preventing China from violating international trading rules. Doing it with our allies on both climate change and the trade question would seem to be a better approach, but that didn't win out so far.
The world is changing in ways that we cannot control. For example, President Trump recently threatened that if terrorists attack America again, we will respond with force like they have never seen. And that is a stirring call. But the reality is that 30, 40 years from now, the Muslim population of the world will be a billion people larger. The population of the United States may be 50 or 80 million people larger. That's not a race we're going to win in any sense simply by threatening use of force. We have to build positive relations with the billions of Muslims living around the world in our society who we do business with.
And not perpetuate stereotypes. Jack Goldstone is professor of public policy at George Mason University and global fellow of the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Well, Jack Goldstone, thank you so much for shedding light on these important trends that are affecting the world. We greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you. These are complicated things. I hope I've made them a little easier to understand.
No question about it. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Nick Ivanoff. And joining me on the program was VOA African Division journalist Salem Solomon. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.